the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. May Martinez. Kamala Harris is on Joe Biden's VP shortlist. Find out how, if he picks her and they win the White House, it'll give Governor Gavin Newsom a tough choice to make. Plus, most LA childcare centers seem to be avoiding any coronavirus outbreaks, but that doesn't mean parents shouldn't be careful and full of safety protocol questions when looking for a place to care for their kids. It's all ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app, this is Take Two. I'm E. Martinez. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. Now, earlier this week, we told you about a tenants group in Burbank that has been fighting to get a rent control initiative on the ballot. Now, it has not been popular with city officials. In about 20 minutes, though, we're going to have a major update on that rent control push. KPCC's Aaron Mendelson will be with us, so stick around for that. But we start this Friday with State of Affairs. That's our weekly look at politics in the Golden State. And this week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi wields more power than ever before, and she's using it to go head-to-head with Republicans over pandemic relief. Meanwhile, we'll look at how Governor Gavin Newsom could play the role of kingmaker if Senator Kamala Harris winds up sharing a ticket with Joe Biden. We're going to get into those stories and more with Zach Corser. He co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Welcome, Zach.
Great to be here, eh?
Also with us, Rafe Sonnenschein, Executive Director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. Rafe, welcome back to you.
Great to be with you, eh?
All right. Diving right in, Zach, White House officials and Democratic leaders ended a three-hour negotiation yesterday evening. No pandemic relief deal in sight. What are some of the biggest disagreements at this point?
Well, in terms of dollars, one of the biggest agreements has to do with state and local support. The Democrats are putting the figure at close to $1 trillion right now for state and local relief. The GOP has basically come back and said they're willing to do about a tenth of that. And so it's a big sticking point about, you know, Trump has characterized state and local relief packages as being a kind of bailout for bad governance. And that's kind of the hard line he's taking. And there's not a lot of compromise on that point. And that's about a third of the entire package that Democrats are thinking about. And the dollar totals are pretty overall starkly different. Dems are at about $3.5 trillion. The GOP, they're starting to say edge up from $1 trillion, but they're still stuck there. And there's other issues in this whole package. You know, the Postal Service is starting to become a topic. Democrats in particular, worried about underfunding the Postal Service as we head into a pandemic election. And there's been some cutbacks at the Postal Service by a Trump appointee. Things about schooling. Trump administration wants to make funding for schooling contingent on opening schools, which is a priority for them. So, you know, there's a lot of politics getting played here. We're getting close to an election. The pandemic's still going on. And everyone seems to be sticking to their guns, despite the fact that the stakes are so high.
And Rafe, after yesterday's negotiations, Nancy Pelosi said that the White House is not taking the consequences of the virus seriously. And the White House says they would consider executive action if a deal isn't reached by the end of today, which we're almost there. We're almost at the end of the day. What do you see happening here, Rafe?
Well, first of all, the clock runs as long as you want the clock to run. And I've seen these negotiations lead to an agreement long after everybody has given up, walked away from the table, slammed the table, called each other names. So I no longer consider there to be actually a clock going on. The notion that most of this stuff can be done by executive action is a typical Trumpian fiction that says we don't really have to negotiate because I'm the president and I can do whatever I want. I don't think anybody thinks he can settle this that way. By the way, the Democrats offered to come down by a trillion if the Republicans would come up by a trillion, which are numbers I would love to be able to have control of in my life. And the Republicans have turned that down. But that could be considered a first offering toward what could become a deal. I think the big thing is the unemployment compensation, the $600 boost that was given in the previous plan. The Democrats want it to be $600. The Republicans want it to be $200 or $400. They may be able to make a deal. I think a deal will happen because a deal is more in the interest of the Republicans than the Democrats. They're the party in power. And all the provisions in the Democratic bill are way more popular than the ones in the Republican bill. You could argue the Democrats could save the Republicans by getting this bill passed.
You guys remember the phrase at the end of the day, you know, when people say that at the end of the day?
In Washington.
Yeah, it reminds me of that Alan Jackson line in the song, It's 5 o'clock somewhere. It's always 5 o'clock somewhere, and it's always at the end of the day somewhere. It's one of those things. Yeah, you're right, Rafe. There is no end of the day anymore deadline. All right, so that gets into the story in Politico that Nancy Pelosi has been emboldened by the majority of Democrats holding the House and the power that she's really worked to consolidate among her own party. Zach, when you look at Speaker Pelosi's actions lately, what do you see in what she's doing?
Well, I mean, I think what we're seeing partly is, you know, she has a very assured position within her caucus. When she was coming into the speakership for the second time, it was a little uncertain at first because there were many progressives who wanted a more progressive leader to hold the gavel. And she very astutely worked her way back into the speakership, and she made some promises. But right now, she's sort of in a very secure position after having to do that. I think it's partly the political hand she's holding right now. You know, Trump is in a slump, and it doesn't look good for November. Things could change. But Pelosi just has a stronger position. You know, she's the speaker. She has an assured caucus. She's very confident about the direction she's headed in. And, you know, she's got a strong reputation going up against Trump during these negotiations. And the last thing is, you know, there's been a consolidation of power in the House of Representatives that's been going on since the 90s. And, you know, it's there's a lot of power focused on the speaker. And I think Nancy Pelosi is an institutionalist. She understands the House of Representatives. She knows how to operate as a speaker. And she's just very effective at managing, you know, that institution, which is not an easy one to get your arms around.
Rafe, what do you think of Speaker Pelosi's actions lately?
Well, I think she's at the top of her game, and there's something amazing at watching a masterful politician with a strong hand to play, as Zach is saying. He's exactly right about that. She's reading polling that her caucus is going to get larger in November, whereas the Republican caucus in the Senate is in danger of losing the majority, so they're in a state of holy terror. Usually Democrats are in a state of holy terror, which is the normal stance of Democrats. So to see a Democratic speaker walking around like she's got this under control. She's got a popular bill and a strong political position. And Trump has never known quite what to do with Nancy Pelosi. He can't successfully make fun of her, and she knows how to needle him in ways that almost nobody else knows how to do. And it's really quite something to see.
By the way, my country western music loving cousin just texted me and said that I omitted Jimmy Buffett as it was a duet. Alan Jackson, Jimmy Buffett is 5 o'clock somewhere. So there you go, CJ in Ventura County. There you go. Now, as it happens, Nancy Pelosi's state here, California, faces some pretty stark economic realities. Unemployment claims still pretty high. And according to a new poll out from the California Policy Lab, only about 61% of people who drew unemployment benefits think that they're going to get their old job back. Wow, Zach, are we crossing a point where the effects of this pandemic will be something we're going to be feeling for years to come, not just for months, but for years?
Well, I think that's why we see such intensity in this battle over the second relief package. You know, the California budget currently is balanced on the hope that there's going to be a significant federal bailout, or not bailout, relief package coming. And if this doesn't happen, there's going to be a prolonged period of cuts in jobs and services at the state level. I think cities are also, you know, California cities are in perilous position beforehand due to pensions and other systematic problems. And they're going to be facing a lot of real trouble trying to put revenue together to basically pay for services. And so the deeper that hole gets, the more expensive and the longer it takes for us to dig out of it. So I think absolutely, you know, what we see between, you know, now and November in terms of, you know, a second relief package is going to mean a lot to how long we're going to feel the pain of the pandemic economically.
Is anyone, though, talking about the impact of this unemployment on our future? I mean, because that's the thing, right? In politics, it's what have you done for me 10 minutes ago and right now, and what are you going to do for me in 10 minutes?
Well, you know, it's short-termism is a problem in a democratic politics. We're always sort of thinking about what's happening right now and taking in new information. And I think, right, you know, as it stands right now, this relief package, I mean, this really is the question. You know, Rafe was talking about the unemployment disagreement about the $600. And it may seem like a policy disagreement now, but I think it could easily blow up into something larger. We can't really focus, though, on what comes next until we get a handle on the pandemic. We don't have it. We don't know what's going to happen in the election. We're still forced to live within all of this uncertainty. And so to see down the road to like what to do for a recovery, we can barely manage our affairs as is. So short of a vaccine or a really solid result in November, I think we're just in more of the same in terms of trying to manage the current situation.
And Rafe, the president says that if he takes executive action, it'll include a payroll tax suspension, eviction protections, even maybe student loan relief. Not clear, though, if he can do this, if he has the power to. Looking at the big picture, I mean, is it going to take a reimagining of the American economy as a whole to dig out from under this?
You know, that's a great question, and I'll tell you why. What these packages really are making up temporarily for the fact that the U.S. has the weakest safety net of social programs of any developed country in the world. And it's only in a massive crisis that we bulk up and make sure people get the security they need. I think when this is over, that temporary adjustment is going to be open for discussion that maybe we should have a stronger safety net in normal times, the way most other developed countries do, which is one reason other countries have handled this crisis much better than we have. This is going to be a fundamental challenge to the way we do business that hasn't probably happened since the 1932 election that brought Franklin Roosevelt to power.
Talking to Rafe Sonnenschein and Zach Corser. This is State of Affairs on 89.3 KPCC. We're going to focus back on California and Governor Gavin Newsom. We've seen him on TV just about every single weekday since March, giving us an update on the virus, usually very information heavy, does not use a teleprompter. But now Politico makes the case that those daily briefings might not have the same comforting effects as the pandemic wears on. Zach, what do you think? And he hasn't been on, I think, for the majority of this week, right? Normally he is on every day, but it hasn't really happened much this week.
Yeah, I think we've all gotten used to listening to the governor during the noontime hour. And yeah, I think it's time to change up, you know, his approach to this. It's very data heavy, you're right. I think probably, you know, as we were talking about before, it's really time to start maybe not sort of monitoring the situation, but sort of expanding his message out to talk about, you know, economic relief, how all these pieces sort of fit together. The Blue Ribbon panel that Newsom put together that was headed by Tom Steyer, we were talking about that in a previous week, they were supposed to set out a roadmap for us. And it seems like, I think anyway, one of Newsom's most constructive roles in this is sort of building that roadmap to the future. The future, like I said, it's uncertain, but that doesn't mean we can plan and iterate and change it up. And I think he needs to do a better job of articulating what that roadmap looks like, as much as he's maybe in the background managing the day-to-day of the pandemic crisis.
And Newsom, what had a 70% approval rating in April, that dropped to about 58% in late May. And since then, there have been a few things that have not gone quite right for California managing the pandemic. Rafe, what does the public think he's not doing now?
Well, I don't think the public thinks of it that way, but Jerry Brown used to say that people don't want to see my face every day on TV. That's a very California observation. In New York, they're used to seeing their politicians. This disaster popularity never really lasts forever, because after a while, you either have to mix it up, do something different, and I'd like to see him spend more time talking about whipping some of the departments of the state in like the EDD with the unemployment disaster, and now the question of whether we're keeping the right numbers for the virus infections. That's a great thing for a governor to do, because he's the chief executive, and I think he could do very well at it. I'm not sure there's an appetite to do more of the same again and again, get more data, especially when the data now is under question.
All right, one more thing today. Presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden expected to announce a VP pick soon. Two California lawmakers on the short list. You got Karen Bass and Kamala Harris. So Zach, if Biden did choose Kamala Harris and they all won in November, it could actually hand some special powers to Governor Newsom. What would that give him the ability to do?
Well, he'd have the power of appointing a senator until a special election. This hasn't happened since Pete Wilson appointed John Seymour back in 91 to replace himself when he became governor. But I think that's also probably telling in some ways. There's a lot of names he could choose. But, you know, remember, Seymour lost pretty handily in 92 to Feinstein. And so I think Newsom's got to be aware of using this power carefully, both to maybe reward an ally or fulfill some kind of political idea that he's got in mind, but also thinking that there's going to be a special election, and this person has to be competitive going into the next election.
Rafe, how attractive would that temporary job be, considering, as we mentioned, that there might be an election, a special election, where they might not have that job after that?
Oh, I think it's phenomenally attractive. Are you kidding me? I mean, basically, most of the people under consideration have term-limited offices. They'd be in, I mean, to go to the Senate would be phenomenal, and they'd be an odds-on favorite to win. Can I just point out for a second how amazing it is that two of the VP candidates at the very top level are from California in a Democratic Party, which often acts as if California is an ATM machine for
campaign finance. We matter, right? For the first time in a long
time.
In
the Democratic Party, you figure it's kind of about time. So I think that's kind of cool.
Rafe Sonnenschein is the executive director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State Los Angeles. Zach Corser co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Zach, Rafe, thanks a lot.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
All right, more Take Two coming up in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. There are relatively few cases of the coronavirus linked to L.A. childcare centers, but KPCC's Mariana Dale reports the data is inconsistent, and there's been at least one outbreak at a childcare center that claims to be following safety guidelines.
On Friday, March 13th, Stephanie Trujillo found out her four-year-old daughter's LAUSD school would close.
I was just panicking, because one, I need to work, and two, her education, she's gonna backtrack.
Trujillo is a behavior specialist. Her daughter is a special education student. She asked Proyecto Pastoral, who runs the child care center her daughter attended after school, and found out they'd be open for essential worker families. Cynthia Sanchez is the executive director of the nonprofit.
We rose to the responsibility and the commitment that we've made to our families. The staff, every day that they came in, put their fears aside.
By April, more than half of Los Angeles daycare centers had closed. Trujillo was relieved her daughter had a place to go.
I see so many people struggling right now, and I'm just grateful that I still got to continue my normal routine.
But that routine was interrupted in July when Proyecto Pastoral had an outbreak of coronavirus. The center was faced with navigating shifting guidelines from state and local agencies about how to operate safely. Childcare providers have complained that the guidelines are often confusing.
There's so much overload of information there that it was pretty hard to decipher.
Tanya Muhammad is a family childcare provider in Hawthorne who's been in the business for 30 years.
The fact that I open my door every day, that's a risk factor. I don't know what the parents are doing when they leave here.
It's tricky to figure out how many coronavirus cases are linked to childcare. The State Department that licenses childcare says there have been 302 such cases in Los Angeles County. But as of July 30th, the LA County Public Health Department had confirmed just 52 coronavirus cases associated with those facilities. It may be that some LA County providers are reporting COVID cases only to the licensing agency, but not to the county health officials. And the two agencies don't necessarily share the same information. Michael Smith is a pediatric infectious diseases physician at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. He says it's likely the coronavirus cases in childcare are not a result of children spreading the virus, but rather a reflection of the transmission happening in the larger community.
That's a little bit difficult to interpret without having the more granular data to be able to analyze.
At Proyecto Pastoral in Boyle Heights, staff followed the state and local safety guidelines. Sanchez says kids were limited to small groups. There was rigorous cleaning, temperature checks, and masks for staff. Then in late June, a teacher who'd been out sick for several days told the center she tested positive for the coronavirus. Within a few weeks, four more teachers tested positive. Stephanie Trujillo found out her daughter was exposed to one of them.
My first instant reaction was scared, but then they called.
She says they explained what happened and how the center was working with a local public health department. Trujillo and her daughter quarantined for 2 weeks before returning to the center.
Coming back, I felt safe.
Sanchez says they were never told to close the child care center. Public health recommended a deep cleaning and followed up the next week with an inspection. Sanchez shared the report with me. And the county offered a few suggestions, including logging temperature checks and updating air filters, but said the center was meeting or exceeding the guidelines to reduce the risk of spreading COVID-19.
We did everything we were told to, and then some. But my realization is, like, in the future, we will do more.
Sanchez says they're reflecting on what it means to operate childcare safely for staff, kids, and the community. Covering early childhood, I'm Mariana Dale.
And now Mariana joins us now to talk about this story. Welcome back.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, good. Now, for the parent you talked to, childcare, an absolute necessity. She wouldn't have been able to work without it. But I'm wondering, for families who currently have their kids in care somewhere or are considering it in the future, what should they be looking out for at a childcare center in terms of safety?
So first of all, parents should be asking questions. And that's a message that I heard from Charles Golden. He's a pediatrician and vice president at CHOC Children's Primary Care Network.
Some of these facilities are doing different things to help keep kids safe and keep staff safe. And it's important for parents to arm themselves with that information before making a decision to send their kid back.
And what are those practices childcare facilities should be opting or adopting to prevent the spread of coronavirus?
Well, there are pages and pages and even more pages of guidelines from local, state, and federal officials. But here are some of the things that, you know, there was really overlap between all these different guidelines. Kids should be cared for in small groups of 10 or fewer. There should be daily health screenings like temperature checks for students and for staff. The center should have a specific plan for cleaning and, like, disinfecting toys. You should look at staff and see that they're wearing masks and or face shields. And kids over 2 years old who will actually keep the masks on should also be wearing them. And some of the guidelines are a little bit sad as someone that covers early childhood, but there's not going to be any more circle time or any other activities that really encourage kids to be close together. And kids should have their own toys, their own set of materials to use, so no more sharing. And like we've been hearing from the very beginning, lots of hand washing.
So no more duck, duck, goose, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. But it makes sense. You don't want kids in a circle. What if they sneeze or something, you know? Now, what have you heard from providers about what it's actually like to implement those guidelines?
Well, it hasn't been easy in almost any regard. It is financially challenging for larger centers because their business model is likely built on having more than 10 kids in the classroom at the same time. So even if they're open, they could be losing money because it's costing them more to operate. And there's a real concern right now that we're going to see childcare businesses permanently close during the pandemic. Another challenge is that providers who are open still cannot find the supplies that they need. 38% of providers who responded to a survey from UC Berkeley's Center for the Study of Childcare Employment said they do not have sufficient protective gear or cleaning supplies. I talked to Tanya Muhammad. She's a home childcare provider in Hawthorne.
We're considered essential workers, but we're not able to get essential supplies from our state. I don't understand that.
And Muhammad says she did get a $900 stipend a few months ago, but that she spent at least twice that much money on supplies.
So I had to resort to alcohol, you know, like buying a gallon of alcohol from a dental supply place and breaking it down to where it would meet the qualifications to be a disinfectant.
Wow, my gosh, that sounds terrible.
Yeah.
Mariana, can you give us a sense of the stories you're going to be working on next?
Well, I'll keep continuing to track these cases in childcare centers, but I have a very long list of stories I'm always working on. Something I'm really trying to understand right now is what type of childcare parents are relying on if they're not sending their kid to a home provider or to a center. It's likely they're asking friends and family to fill in the gap. And I actually was able to go out into the real world recently.
Oh, nice.
I'm talking to you from my kitchen table right now. I visited an LA teacher who's trying to bring more books to South Central since so many schools and libraries have closed. And that story should be up sometime next week.
All right. Nice. KPCC Early Childhood Education Reporter, Mariana Dale. Mariana, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, we like to periodically check in with KPCC reporter Aaron Mendelson on issues affecting tenants and landlords. And there was also a dramatic update to a story Aaron's been covering in Burbank. Aaron, welcome back.
Great to be here, eh?
All right, so remind us, what's the issue in Burbank?
Yeah, so a tenants group in Burbank has been fighting to get an initiative on the ballot about rent control. Rent control, of course, is very controversial. Tenants groups often favor it, but landlords hate it. Cities like LA and West Hollywood have it, but it's actually pretty rare across the state. Fewer than 20 of California's 400-plus cities have some form of rent control. This proposed measure in Burbank would tie rents to the Consumer Price Index with a maximum increase of 7% each year and applying to units built before 1995. It would also establish a just cause evictions, meaning landlords would be required to have a reason for evicting tenants, and it would strengthen a landlord-tenant commission in the city.
You know, and the tenant activists got the signatures they needed for this ballot measure, almost 8,000 of them. But as you reported, that was not popular with elected officials in Burbank.
It was not, no. It faced waves of resistance from Burbank politicians. First, the city clerk filed the lawsuit trying to stop it on procedural grounds. A judge disagreed with that, said it should go on the ballot. But by the time that ruling came down, Burbank City Council had mounted their own legal challenge. The city council has been pretty clear that they do not favor rent control as a policy. And in court, they argued that the ballot measure fatally conflicts with the city's charter. There was a hearing about this morning, today is the last day for an initiative to get on the ballot. So it's really coming down to the wire.
So tell me what happened.
So the judge sided with the tenants group. In her ruling, she wrote that the city did not make a clear showing that the initiative conflicts with the city charter. She said that lawyers for both sides made some reasonable arguments, and it's best to leave those for after the election in case this passes. This should pave the way for voters to decide on rent control in Burbank in November. So that's good news for the tenant activists who have been saying the city is wasting public money on these legal challenges.
And there's going to be, housing politics that's going to be heating up, not just in Burbank, but all over California. They're going to be housing issues on the ballot this year again, right?
Yes. So listeners might remember the statewide ballot measure in 2018 about rent control. That one failed badly, but nevertheless, we're going to see a sequel to that this year, Prop 21, which would allow cities across the state to create and expand rent control. One that you're going to hear about a lot is Prop 15, also known as Split Roll. It's about taxes, but is actually really fascinating. It would do away with part of Prop 13, the famous or notorious, depending on how you look at it, law that ties property taxes to the original sale price of the parcel. That wouldn't affect residential property, so no one's home is going to be impacted by this, but it would tax commercial property based on its market value. This one change could raise billions of dollars, be good news for schools and local government budgets, but it might mean much bigger tax bills for some commercial property owners.
And if past elections are any indication, we're going to be hearing a lot about that because groups on both sides could spend a lot of money to advance their causes. Aaron, while we got you, though, I want to ask you about evictions. Where are we at with eviction protections in California?
Yeah, so right now, almost all evictions in the state are halted. They can't move forward in court. We've heard people like Governor Gavin Newsom say that this is a public health issue, that they don't want people locked out of homes and then spreading the virus or falling into homelessness. And there's this fear, because we're in a devastating recession, that a tsunami of evictions could be imminent without some form of protections. And so it's a really big deal that California's courts could lift this moratorium on eviction cases as soon as next Friday, August 14th.
Wow, yep, next Friday.
Next Friday.
That would be a big change. I mean, so what's the thinking behind starting up evictions proceedings in courts?
Well, so the Judicial Council, this group that oversees courts in California, they have not been processing eviction cases since April. They are saying that gave lawmakers time to come up with solutions, and that basically it's not the judicial branch's job to come up with an answer here. Lawmakers have not you know, come up with a statewide answer. They say they need more time. They're not going to have a bill ready, most likely by next week. It's not clear if they will get that time, though.
And if the courts start processing evictions again, that could mean people who have lost their income due to the pandemic and recession could be locked out of their homes. A lot of cities, though, and counties adopted their own rules on evictions when the pandemic set in the spring. Aren't there local rules to protect tenants on this?
Yeah, so there are in places like LA County. So if you live anywhere in LA County, not just the city of LA, but any of the other 87 cities around here, you are covered by this eviction moratorium. But many parts of the state don't have an eviction moratorium, and it's a really confusing situation for tenants to navigate. The ramifications of restarting evictions are potentially huge. Just this morning, a report came out showing that around 35% of renter households in California are at risk of eviction. This is as many as 5.4 million people. The report also says this risk disproportionately impacts Black and Latino renters and renters who have children.
That's something they're going to be following in the weeks to come. KPCC's Aaron Mendelson catching us up on renter issues during the pandemic. Aaron, as always, thanks a lot.
Good talking with you, eh?
For decades, the movie Gone with the Wind was considered a cinematic national treasure, an absolute movie classic. Well, not anymore.
The film elides all the torture and cruelty and atrocities of slavery. That's a real problem.
The movie's been around for over 80 years, but its softened version of racism has not really aged gracefully. We're going to find out how when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. The Civil War epic Gone with the Wind made its world premiere over 80 years ago, but the film has been in the public conversation in recent months for its troubling depictions of race, slavery, and its continued place in Hollywood history. In June, Oscar-winning screenwriter John Ridley called on HBO Max to take Gone with the Wind off of its platform, saying it romanticizes the Confederacy. The service did temporarily pull the film from rotation. Now it's contextualizing it with a disclaimer. Reporter Stephen Cuevas has been looking at the making of the movie and what it says about race in America then and now.
Gone with the Wind may be set in Atlanta, but the city itself was still so battle-scarred 75 years after the end of the war that every frame would end up being shot in and around Los Angeles. It may have seemed like a long way from the segregated South, but the racial tensions flared here as well.
The first day of shooting, I noticed all the outdoor porta potties, and I couldn't believe my eyes. Each potty had a sign above the door. White, colored all the way down.
When he was 19, actor Lenny Blewett got hired as an extra playing a Black Union soldier. In an interview he did with Turner Classic Movies, Blewett said he was so angry at the sight of these segregated toilets that he marched across the studio lot to the trailer of the film's leading man, Clark Gable.
He called Victor Fleming, the director, "Get me Vic!" And he called the property master. And I don't know who else he called, but he cussed like a sailor. And he said, "If you don't get those GD signs down, you don't have a Rhett Butler in this film."
What ended up on screen largely erased the horrors of racism, slavery, and the so-called lost cause. That's the belief among many Southerners that the Confederacy wasn't fighting to keep Black people enslaved, but to preserve some idealized Southern way of life. The black actors are credited as servants, not house slaves. They're never whipped, they're never chained or lynched. So it's easy to start seeing them more as extended family members. The film would also have us believe that slaves like Mammy, played by Hattie McDaniel, are free to talk back to and even reprimand their slave owners, as Mammy does repeatedly to the lovesick Scarlett O'Hara.
Savannah would be better for you. You just get in trouble in Atlanta.
What trouble are you talking about?
You know what trouble I was talking about. I was talking about Mr. Ashton Wilkes. He'll be coming to Atlanta when he gets his leave, and you're sitting there waiting for him just like a spider.
Mammy is an all-knowing, all-seeing, all-basically understanding character.
Film historian Donald Bogle is the author of the landmark book Toms, Coons, Mulattoes, Mammies, and Bucks, an interpretive history of blacks in American films. In an interview for Turner Classic Movies, he talked about seeing McDaniel in the film as a young black man.
I knew that, you know, there were things they weren't telling me. I said, well, you know, where does Mammy live? You know, does she go out to slave quarters at night? Does she have a room in the big house? How does she feel about the war itself?
When I visited Atlanta last year, I stopped by the historic Oakland Cemetery. It's the final resting place for some 7,000 Confederate soldiers. And for Gone with the Wind author Margaret Mitchell.
Since coming back, I'm a little taller than I used to be, but I think it's from laying flat all those years. I just kind of pancaked out a little bit.
Okay, it's not the ghost of Margaret Mitchell. It's Sally Smith. She's a longtime cemetery volunteer who also moonlights as a Mitchell expert and impersonator. Smith says she rereads Gone with the Wind pretty frequently, and she's grown more and more critical over the years. To her, it represents a way of bigoted thinking that still persists across parts of the South.
That's sort of the problem about the Old South and the Lost Cause. They paint this very benign picture of the South.
Among some of the worst offenses, Mitchell uses the N-word over 60 times in the novel. The early rise of the KKK is also depicted in a positive light. So I asked Sally Smith how the Gone with the Wind author would defend her novel, and she slips right into character as Margaret Mitchell.
It was just a story that I wrote during my convalescence. So I did not set out to write an expose on slavery or whatever. I was not defending slavery. It's just a story of a woman. It's a story of survival. And this is the world that she was in. And that's all I can say, you know.
The film elides all the torture and cruelty and atrocities of slavery. That's a real problem.
That's Professor Matt Bernstein. He's a film historian at Atlanta's Emory University.
I mean, Mitchell is following a narrative line of plantation novels that started being written in the 1880s and 1890s. So I think that whole piece of what the plantation, what Tara and 12 Oaks rests on is the slave labor. And that's left pretty much off screen, except for the opening scenes of the slaves picking cotton in the fields.
Bernstein says producer David O. Selznick had to win over Atlanta's white establishment or risk losing Southern audiences and the support of Margaret Mitchell. There was already grumbling that the film wasn't shot in Georgia and that Scarlett O'Hara was played by a British actress. To soothe the tension, Selznick put on a glitzy parade and held the world premiere in Atlanta.
Diminutive Margaret Mitchell, the author, who rarely appears in public, attends to see her brainchild and is excited beyond words.
VIPs included a handful of surviving Confederate soldiers and most of the film's white stars, but no African Americans. And that includes Hattie McDaniel and her black co-stars. But you could say that McDaniel had the last laugh.
I present the Academy Award for the best performance of an actress in supporting roles during 1939 to Hattie McDaniel.
McDaniel would famously become the first African-American actor to win an Academy Award.
I sincerely hope I shall always be a credit to my race and to the motion picture industry. And may I say thank you and God bless you.
But she'd also be forced to sit at a back table during the Oscar ceremony at LA's Ambassador Hotel. And for the rest of her career, she'd win few roles that were not some variation of Mammy.
The opportunities at that time and the way that those in power and in that business were marginalizing us and not allowing us to grow and thrive after that was just terrible. And a lot of that is still around today.
That's Queen Latifah, who recently spoke to the Associated Press. She portrays Gone with the Wind actress Hattie McDaniel in the new Netflix series Hollywood. Today's debate around Gone with the Wind raises questions about how entertainment has shown our history of race on screen and who's gotten to tell those stories. And as the country reconsiders this classic film that historian Matt Bernstein says once defined Atlanta, we can see how far we've come and the great lengths we still need to travel. For Take Two, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
You know, when I heard President Trump was thinking about banning TikTok, I thought, what did Kesha ever do to him? And then I went past the headline and read the story, and I realized it's the app, not the song. We'll hear all about that when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
Take on me. Take me.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. This week, the Trump administration announced restrictions on Chinese apps TikTok and WeChat. Now, they don't go into effect for 45 days, but if and when they do, the executive orders would essentially ban American users and companies from using those apps. Clayton Duby is director of the USC US-China Institute. He joins us now to talk about what this news means. Clayton, welcome.
It's great to be with you.
All right. Now, why is it important that Trump is looking to ban TikTok and WeChat? What do those apps do?
Well, it's very clear that they plan to ban TikTok. It's not entirely clear what's intended with regard to WeChat. The use of the term transactions is complicated. But the two apps are enormously popular. In terms of TikTok, it is China's first international app sensation. They have great apps within China. They dominate the market there. But TikTok is the only Chinese app that's gone big internationally. It was number one in India before it was banned, and it was the fastest rising app here in the United States. It's a short video app. It draws on the inspiration of Vine, and now it's being copied by Snap and by Instagram and by others. WeChat is even bigger. Within China, WeChat has somewhere close to a billion users. And virtually everybody who does anything with Chinese, including business people here in the United States, they use WeChat. It is the number one form of communication with China, far bigger than email, far bigger than any other platform. And you don't just communicate using WeChat. You buy groceries, you order food, you make a reservation for a movie or any number of other things. WeChat is the do-it-all app in China.
And of all the places in the country, LA is probably the biggest market for WeChat users as well as TikTok users and creators. How come?
Well, in terms of TikTok users, they're throughout the United States. And it's important to note that TikTok actually, in terms of the United States, is based here in Los Angeles. Its headquarters are at in Culver City, where they have 400 employees using over 100,000 square feet of space, where they've been doing all of these things for quite some time. They have a former Disney executive as their operating officer. So it's big, but TikTok, it's important to note, doesn't operate in China. The Chinese use a separate app in China. It's owned by the same company and the functionality is very similar, but they did it specifically to try to reach an international audience. And so TikTok is huge here in Southern California. Young people everywhere are using it, But WeChat is also huge. If, again, you're from China or you have Chinese business, Chinese contacts, you are using WeChat.
And LA is influencer central in the United
That's
States.
Right.
So there you go with TikTok. Now, for people using WeChat in LA to connect with their families, what happens, Clayton, if that goes away? Are there alternatives?
Well, I'm one of the people that will have to find an alternative. I connect with many people in China, former students, current students, business associates, all sorts of people. Plus, we use WeChat to pick up information from certain organizations that use that as a broadcast channel. All people who connect with friends and family in China would have to find some alternative. And there are alternative chat platforms, including Microsoft, which has Skype, which is not banned in China, but doesn't have anywhere near the functionality. It's not designed to function like WeChat. But WeChat, people use to make telephone calls. They use to share pictures, to share short videos. They use it to comment on things. You have discussion groups. It is, again, that do-everything app. And there isn't a single app that can replace it.
Oh, so you could be cutting off, or we could be cutting off a huge group of people from another huge group of people. So I'm wondering, what is the Chinese government's direct influence on these apps?
Well, the direct influence, first of all, the reason why there is a separate app for the world, TikTok, and an app for China is because within China, the company ByteDance is required to censor content according to Chinese standards. And so rather than imposing those Chinese standards worldwide, they tried to have it separate because they know this is an issue. And so they created this separate, this firewall between the two and house the servers in the United States and do all these kinds of things. So the influence on TikTok is less complete. They have on TikTok, the TikTok platform, they have engaged in some censorship. They blocked an account for a young woman who had talked about the situation with Uyghurs, that sort of thing. With WeChat, it's really quite different because a lot of time and energy goes in China to trying to control public opinion, to dominate the public opinion space. And so all the censorship requirements that are imposed on news organizations and social media platforms within China, WeChat has to carry out. And if you are a user of WeChat and your account is tied to a Chinese phone number, that's where you started using WeChat, then your censorship travels with you. And you have access to the World Wide Web, but if you're using the WeChat platform, the Chinese standards of censorship still apply. And so that kind of impact is tremendous. These are large, privately owned companies, and the owners are aimed at the profit motive, and they try to meet the needs of their customers, but they both have to listen to the Chinese government.
One last thing, Clayton. What are the consequences of extending international boundaries into internet policies?
Well, I think this is a giant challenge, and it's one that we've only begun to wrestle with. This is the question of internet sovereignty, the notion that America's boundaries extend into cyberspace and that we have some jurisdictional rights. Now, we didn't invent this idea. The Chinese did. And that's why Facebook is blocked. That's why Google is blocked. That's why Twitter is blocked and a whole host of other platforms in China. They just don't let them in. That's unfair market access. Other countries have picked it up. Russia is now a champion of this. And now it seems so is the United States.
That's Clayton Dubey, director of the U.S.-China Institute at USC. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, finally, if you're looking for ways to freshen up your weekend routine, we're here to help you out.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran and A. Martinez. Hope your comfy couch is ready for another weekend. Because if you're planning to go to one of those massive party houses, what is wrong with you?
Okay, that's good, because I thought you were going to give us tips on how to find these parties, Leo.
Oh, gosh. No, geez. I'm too old for that.
Yeah, all right. Now, this first event you got, though, is a celebration of all things television.
Yeah, well, since life is all about streaming things right now, lean into it and celebrate your favorites. Starting today, PaleyFest LA goes virtual. For those not in the know, PaleyFest is this annual meetup where creators and stars of your favorite TV shows get together, talk directly to fans and industry professionals alike, and share some cool behind-the-scenes details. Usually, this is in person, but probably out of all the things virtual happening, this feels the most appropriate one to do online. This year's highlights will include Mrs. America, Ozark, One Day at a Time, Queer Eye, and my personal favorite, Ew David, Schitt's Creek, and all those show stars are scheduled to take part. The way to watch is a little different, though, so here's how it works. If you are a Citibank cardholder or a Paley member or front $75 to become a Paley member, then you can start streaming those talks today. But if you can wait a few days, those talks become free to all on Monday, August 10th.
All right, perfect. What if, though, Leo, I need a cuddly creature with me on the couch?
Well, quarantine has led to a lot of people adopting pets. Actually, I was just talking to my friend and Morning Edition host, Noah King, who broke down and just adopted one herself.
Oh, nice.
So if you haven't made the move yet yourself, what's keeping you? Get a friend to keep you company. Starting tomorrow and lasting for 10 days, it's Cuteness Overload Kitten Edition. This is a virtual adoption event that works like online dating, so you can meet potential pets online and put in applications. Then you can meet them virtually before setting up an appointment so you can meet your possible new cat in person. The adoption fees are $150, which of course goes back into helping other animals in need before they get adopted too.
All right, finally, what's a good event to settle into for this weekend and try to relax?
Then listen to some great music, as well as giving back to the community starting tonight at 7. The LA Philharmonic hosts a fundraiser for the Youth Orchestra of LA. So it'll perform a free concert online featuring members of the Youth Orchestra alongside singer Brandi Carlile, conductor Gustavo Dudamel, and more. Being able to enjoy is free, but naturally, donations are encouraged so that young musicians will have a chance to continue their passions even with a lockdown. Now, there are still a bunch more events to go to, even if you are on your couch. You can find out all the things to do this weekend by heading to our site, laist.com. That is laist.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at Leo Has a Cat. Yes, I already have my own cat.
That's KPECC's Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
See you later, A.
That is it for Take Two this week. The show was directed by Lori Skywalker Galaretta. Leo Duran, Carolyn Champlin produced this week. Darby Maloney was our editor. Hazmik Pogosian, our engineer. Marina Pena is our news apprentice. Austin Cross was our senior producer this week. And find us wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on Twitter at Take Two. I'm there as well at amartinezla. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.